This is Dan Austin. The date is February 20th, 1991. I'm in my office at Nova University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with George Maloney, former umpire in the American League. And this is for the archives of the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Bill, may I call you Bill?
You could, except my name is George.
I know it. George, if you tell us where you were born, the year, and really as a child, how you got involved in baseball.
Well, I was born in New York City in 1928, as the encyclopedia says, regrettably. I attended grade schools in Manhattan, Catholic schools, and we all played baseball, but mostly we played stickball. Plus, we were all frustrated major leaguers every time we saw somebody. Willie Mays used to come and play stickball with
a
group on our street.
So you were born in, you were raised in the Bronx?
Manhattan. No,
Manhattan.
Right in Manhattan, right above pole grounds. You could look into the pole grounds from my roof and see from, like, second base sitting off there. I went into the Navy when I was 15 and did not really participate in high school sports except basketball. We played local baseball teams, and each parish had a baseball team, and I played, but I was never good enough. I never could hit a bird ball anyway. And I always wanted to be in sports. I went into the Navy in 1943, came out in 1946, and then went into the Army in 1948. And while a member of the Army, they sent me to an umpire school in Sanford, Florida, in George Barr School. And everything evolved from that. I started working professional ball in 1952 and went at it for a long time. Mm-hmm.
You grew up in the era where you had the balloon chest protector.
Well, all my time in the minor leagues, I never used a balloon. I used
an
inside protector. And at that time, of course, the rivalry existed where the National League wore the inside and the American League wore the outside. So fortunately or unfortunately, I was sold to the American League, never having used a balloon. So the first time I ever used one was in the big leagues. It's quite a change.
And I always now Larry Knapp tells me that that's the way to go. We ought to bring back the balloon chest protector and forget about this inside thing, because it keeps the umpire from moving his head too much.
Well, there are a lot of theories, and that would be Larry's. Larry's from an old school.
Uh-huh.
I think any umpire that is a good umpire won't move his head anywhere, whether he's inside or outside. It's just what you adopt to. I never had any problem with the inside. I use it now, and sometimes in a college game, just having fun.
Okay. So Willie Mays would, as a kid, well, when he came up with the Giants then, would come over and play stickball with...
He lived about five blocks from me. He lived about 168th Street in Amsterdam Avenue. And we played stickball on 164th. And because I was finished playing then. I think I was in the Navy, just gotten out of the Navy. I forget the years. With the younger kids who were there then.
Had been probably 52, 53, something like that?
Just before I went into baseball. I went in at 52, and I think it might have been 51.
Uh-huh.
It was fun.
I always heard, as a Midwesterner, and I always heard a lot about stickball. I never played it. We always had a sandlot that we could go to, and you just played it on the street. You just had a stick and a ball, and first base was hidden between two cars, I guess.
Sometimes the car was first base. Sewers, mostly.
Those were the bases.
There were manhole covers, they were bases. Buildings across the street were, of course, was the backdrop. That was the fence. It was quite an interesting game. An awful lot of money was spent in those games. Bet.
How's that? One team against the other?
Oh, Lord. The whole neighborhood would bet on these games. There'd be riots after them or before them.
I mean, you had your own team, and
sure.
Then you'd play...
Each block had its own team. It was kind of a gang affair.
Yeah.
It was kind of a gang neighborhood. I lived through an era there where everything was gangs, just as it's getting back to now, I guess. Everything repeats itself.
Yeah.
But we had gangs, and we all played stickball, and we fought, but we bet a lot of them. We didn't bet because we didn't have any. We were kids, but the neighborhood bet.
And when Willie Mays would come there, it's incredible that, you don't hear many stories of a major league star going out playing stickball with the kids, whether New York or any other place.
You know, he'd get up and he'd hit mostly. He didn't play in a game, but he'd come by and he'd meet all the kids and take a lick with the stick once in a while.
Now, he played for both teams on offense then.
Well, he didn't really play. He just took a lick a few times, let everybody meet him, and then he'd go to the polo grounds and play.
And play.
He was quite a character.
That's good. And
I forget the woman he was married to then, but I know he divorced her.
Yeah. So the military put you through umpire school.
The Army did. They sent
me
to school, right? Actually, we were stationed.
I didn't know that was part of vocational preparation in the U.S. Army. I never heard of that.
This is just before career, actually, 52, I guess, during career. 1950, they sent me to school. No, excuse me, 51. I was stationed in Fort Bliss, Texas.
Is that because you just like sports and they said,
no,
we'll send you there?
No, not really. I was living in a gymnasium. I was coaching basketball and broadcasting football. And I had a room in a gymnasium. And I remember the Colonel Ball put up a notice that he wanted 4 volunteers to go to umpire school in Florida. And it was awfully cold in El Paso in December. So I volunteered, and I got in a line behind 20 or 30 fellows, and they were all telling him how much they had umpired, and he kept saying, you don't need it, you don't need it. So when I got to the head of the line, I just said I'd never umpire again, but I'd like to try it. So he sent me to school, and it's all evolved from that, from goofing off from cold weather into...
I think there's more to it than that. I can't... because I had a brother that went to umpire school, he... graduated, did well, but he couldn't yell out balls and strikes loud enough, so they never did take him up. But
it was my ambition. I always wanted to be in sports. I played, but I was never a quality ball player in any sport. I played them all, but I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere as a player.
So
but this really was a means to an end.
Okay.
It worked out for me. I got very lucky.
So umpire school was a couple of months long.
It was 6 weeks, I think, at that time.
Tell me... I know there's some basic things about positioning, whether you're out there on first, third, or behind the plate, but how much detail do you go into in the rules? You know, the manual, it must be this thick worth of rules, and there's no way you can memorize it.
No, but I think...
Or would you care to? So
no, you wouldn't want to start with. But I think rules basically are... They're all geared to common sense anyway. And if you learn the basic rules like infield flies and what constitutes a run and what doesn't, what happens in certain situations, you can handle the ball game. Umpiring is not balls and strikes, chase and outs. It's a handling of a situation. And the only way you can learn that, of course, is on the field.
Yeah.
The schools are great. I love them. I think they do a great job. They do teach basics. They teach rules. They teach positioning, which is important, and timing.
I've heard that when you... that third base is kind of the lazy man's position for an umpire.
We call it the crowd counter. You just stand there, kind of count the crowd.
And look for the beautiful woman up there on the long third base side or something like that?
Well, I was using a euphemism there, I guess. Basically, we were looking at the women. Yes,
yeah.
True.
But, therefore, in some ways, that's more difficult to be there because it's easy to get detracted from the game and forget what goes on.
It was a trouble spot. I think the most trouble I had in any league was always at third base.
Third base.
You'd fall asleep. I don't even like the four-man system. It just lulls you to sleep. It doesn't make you work.
So three-man that you get to shift around a little bit.
Well, you shift on every ball that's hit.
Yeah, that's right.
I love it. I think it's great.
And that keeps you... when I played first base as a kid... we had a lot of, you know, volunteer umpires. This was in, you know, kid leagues and like that in high school. And I had to get mad at the umpire because I know that that guy was out and the sound of that glove, ball hitting that glove, was before his foot hit first base. As an umpire, did you, when you were there at first base, did you listen or did you use your eyes or both? Went on a close play.
Well, there again, it goes back to basic positioning, which you learn in school, and you learn also on the field. But I never listened for anything. I just tried to get into a position where I could see the entire play, the overall picture, rather than look up and look at the hand or look down at the feet and listen to the sound. I would try to get far enough away.
And how far is that? 15 feet? 20 feet?
Depends on the play sometimes. It's instinctive. I don't know what else to call it. You just have to get a position for the big picture. Not part of it, but the big picture. The feet, the hands, the ball. Everything has to be in the picture.
So you're going to have to be at least 15 feet away from the first baseman.
Yeah, but not on tag plays now. We're talking about
force plays. Uh-huh.
You don't want to be too close to a force play because you can't see it all. And you need to see the entire picture. You need to see the man catching the ball, maybe juggling. You have to see the feet on the bag.
So it might be 20 feet then.
Could be. Yeah, 15 is pretty good. 15 is pretty good.
So you're really for the whole picture rather than listening for the sound of the ball and of the glove?
Well, listening for the sound went out in about 1820 when they started banging the glove with the hand.
Okay.
Before the ball got there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
sort of evolved umpiring into a little different science. Yeah.
Well, it shows you how far I progressed in umpiring then.
People still think it. People all the time said, you listen for the sound, and you can't do that. First of all, you got 65,000 people in the stands. You can't hear a ball.
You can't hear a ball. Second base, double play. Now, George, I got to tell you that I know that a lot of shortstops and second basemen's foot was no more near that bag, but they kicked up a lot of dirt, and the umpire would force out. How'd you do that then?
Well, I can only give you my own theory. I can't speak for the other umpires. Okay. I can only speak for myself. My theory was that if you got an out by cheating, I called the man safe.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, you would not get the play at first base. You wouldn't get the back end of that double play unless you cheated at second base.
That's right.
So I would call the man at second base safe if you cheated. But if he was going to get it no matter what and he was protecting himself from getting hurt, I would probably give it to him. Mm-hmm. So there again, it's instincts and whether you think a man is cheating for a purpose.
So you really got to know your players on that.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Oh, definitely. You need to know the players and the personalities.
Because I remember I used to see Billy Martin kick up a lot of dirt around second base.
Yeah, but he got the hell out of there, too. Because he was a marked man anyway. They were always after him.
They came in high
sure,
on him.
Sure. So he had to get out of there, so you'd give him a little leeway. There were a lot of them like that.
So that's why you use common sense in that way.
Again, common sense. Everything in baseball is based on common sense.
And don't make it complicated.
No. Why fix something that's not broken? It's just
that's
an easy game. And it is a game.
Yeah. Of all the ballparks, now you umpired in a lot of the old ballparks before they became the new ones that were built for crowd control. Of course, being in the American League, you had Comiskey, you had Fenway. I'm trying to think of, I don't know, did you, no, 69, you wouldn't have been in Sportsman's Park in St. Louis then.
No.
Tell me, every park has to be different. You know, I think of the Green Wall in Boston. As an umpire, how did you prepare to go into, let's say, Fenway Park, as opposed to Anaheim with the California Angels? What did you...
I think you had to have an entirely different mental outlook when you went into Boston because it was such a complicated ballpark. There were so many ground rules, so many rules covering balls going into holes in the fences and coming off a lip and coming off the fence. Fan interference was very prevalent there.
But it comes off of a lip on the fence, so what?
Well, there was some where it was in play, there was some where not. They had lines on the wall if it hits to the right of the line or the left of the line or it hits the line. For instance, in center field, where the bleachers met the green monster, as you call it, there's a line there. And if it hits on the right side of that line, it comes back on the field. It's a home run. But you're talking about a line that's 450 feet away from home plate. So you have to see whether it's that much to the right of the line or it hits the line. So there's a lot involved in the Boston ballpark. Are you going to feel like Anaheim or Kansas City where everything's pretty symmetrical?
Yeah.
There are no overhangs. Fan interference is at a minimum because the stands are raised.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cup of tea.
Yeah. Sunday afternoon picnic.
Yeah, really. But Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park, any place where there's fan interference is always a problem.
Yeah, because...
Milwaukee is bad, too. The fan interference because they hung over with their beer cans on.
That's right, because that fence was really maybe up to your...
it was right there.
Yeah, your waist or something, and...
It was tough. Any place where you had to have a lot of ground rules, fan interference made it difficult.
On fan interference, you can take a blatant thing where, but let's say a right fielder in that short Yankee right field, and he goes back, and the fan snares it right out of the guy's glove. What would you do there?
Well, if he has reached over onto the playing field to get the ball, you can call the batter out.
Mm-hmm. Once it goes over
but
that,
if he's reached
plane.
Into the stands and the player and the fans take it away from him, it's a home run.
It's a home run.
He's fair game.
Fair game on that.
What's
that?
And he is fair game. They get beat up.
That's right. Really some good. Of them got probably a couple swipes.
I've seen them fall off the damn balconies trying to get balls. So just anything.
The balcony.
Yeah, right off. Milwaukee won it right out of the stand. They'll do anything to get a ball. To get it, at that time, $1.75 or a $2 ball, they would kill themselves.
Might end up with a $1,000 hospital bill
like
for a $2 ball.
They were like gold. I never could understand it. I guess just having that many of them, you don't even think of it. But fans go crazy for balls.
Yeah, I bet.
Watch
yeah.
them in the stands and they kill each other.
I know it.
They wear gloves.
I know. I always take my glove when I go to the game.
It's incredible what they'll do for a ball.
I know. I lost a $15 shirt one time over an $8 ball.
I've gotten $300 suits with four balls. I have a haberdasher tell you, come just bring me a couple of balls and I'll give you a suit. It's true. It's incredible. Balls are money out there. Balls are money.
Any particular plays that you remember in Fenway that were controversial that you called that?
No, I don't. I never really had much trouble in Boston. Boston was that was a problem to start with. So everything was kind of controversial there. But I never really can remember too much.
Do you consider them the best educated ball fans in the American League?
Certainly the most bigoted.
But you're Irish Catholic.
I don't know if I am or not. I'm mostly English and French and Norwegian. But
oh, are you? Oh, okay.
I am Catholic, but they're pretty bigoted up there. They really let the black ball players have it. They're tough up there. But then you see that, because I'm going back when it wasn't quite so prevalent anyway. But Boston's a tough town. It's a tough town.
I always thought they were, baseball-wise, they were the most knowledgeable fans in the American League. That's all what I've always heard.
I don't know what constitutes a knowledgeable fan.
Appreciating a good play.
Well, I think most parks are. They're a little more boisterous in Boston, a little more vocal.
Yeah.
Perhaps they show it more. But even in a place like Kansas City, which I think is probably the most laid-back ballpark, where there's very seldom a cheer or a scream or a holler, they're pretty knowledgeable. They know the game.
Well, Kansas City has, of course, that's my hometown. Yeah. But
it's a laid-back community,
basically.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's right.
And you don't really see them with the wave and all the...
No.
It's a very laid-back park, but they're pretty knowledgeable. They know what they're doing. I've spoken to some of their clubs out there. They know what they're doing.
Kansas City's always been a good baseball town.
Oh, yeah. It was a good sports town.
Yeah.
I think. Good sports town.
I'd like to throw out a few names of people that you umpired with. And whatever you want to say.
Is this a quick reaction quiz?
Well, not necessarily that, but now, Coach Handley tells me you are the most fantastic storyteller in baseball today. Our coach of Nova University baseball team.
Sonny,
yeah. Let me just throw out a few. Frank Eumann. Now, I think he was the first one to wear glasses, first umpire to wear glasses on the field. What do you remember about Frank and something about his umpiring, the way he umpired a game?
I remember Frank as being one of the strongest human beings I've ever met in my life, and he's still the same man. I think he's about 75.
Physically, you mean?
Yeah. He's just as hard a man as you'll ever want to see. I can remember in your hometown in Kansas City, I was working with Frank, and a doctor came in to check him. He had a toothache, he thought. The doctor came in and took one of those probes. Went into his jawline. And Frank had a cracked jaw. And he just kept probing and asking Frank if it hurt. Now, Frank is the macho image from day one, but he was tough. And he just kept grunting. And the tears were rolling down his eyes. Nothing made Frank cry. These were tears of pain. It wasn't, it wasn't sorrow, it was pain. Frank, very strong human being. Very strong man.
Mm-hmm.
I love him.
Did you take a lot of ribbing wearing eyeglasses on the field?
I didn't work with Frank with glasses, so I don't know. He didn't have them when I worked with him.
Okay.
If he wore them later, I didn't see him.
Okay.
I didn't see him, but he was great to work with. Him. A lovable man.
And he's still living?
Oh, yes.
Where's he live, you know?
Frank lives in Pompano.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, he lives in Pompano Beach. And matter of fact, we went to his wife's funeral about a month ago, 2 months ago, I guess.
Okay.
But Frank's alive and well. He's
alive and well. Wonderful. Wonderful.
He can tell you some stories.
Okay. Well, I'll have to give him. Johnny Rice.
John Rice. The player or the umpire?
The umpire.
Rice was a politician even in baseball. And
that's
he's
what
still
I heard.
A politician. He could umpire. Rice was Knapp's partner for years.
Yeah,
I said you might before, but I was wrong. It was Rice. John was a nice man. I like him. I never worked with him, so I don't know
too much about him. Well, did you, as an umpire crew, you really just worked with four throughout the given throughout a season then?
You married three men for a year.
You married the whole three men?
You married three men for a year.
And that would be for just for one year?
One season. Usually they change two men on a crew every year. The crew chief usually got a choice for one man. And Knapp's choice always was Rice.
Yeah.
They all had somebody that they could pal around with and talk to.
Yeah, talk to them.
And the other two went their own way. They called me the shadow because nobody ever knew where I was. I didn't fly with them. I didn't stay in the same hotel. So I just stayed by myself.
Oh, really?
I like my privacy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't hang around with anybody too often.
So you wouldn't stay in the same hotels with the teams?
No, very. It happened occasionally, but by accident.
By accident.
We knew where they stayed, and we avoided that.
Let me digress for a moment from some other umpires that you dealt with. Baseball, we had the Black Sox scandal of 1919. There have been a few other incidents, but generally with one player or two. But I've never heard anything remotely of a scandal dealing with any umpire in professional baseball. And so you must have learned that in umpire school or from the president of the American League or the tradition that could go on for so many years. And the association, that doesn't happen by accident. So where do you, did you learn that in umpire school or just learn it from some of the...
I think basically you have to give the credit to the league presidents and the people who do the scouting. You pick people with a character that wouldn't be in any way set baseball back.
Uh-huh.
You have to give them the credit.
Like Joe Cronin?
Sure.
Is the MD? Is the MD? Are they
part of the
Sorry.
There have been times when umpires have gotten in trouble. I'm not going to go into names, but with checks and things of that nature and things like that have cost them their jobs, but they've never been involved in a scandal that would have been a blackface for...
in the major leagues just for a short time and others stay on for years and years, but I never heard a hint of it anywhere.
I think if there were a gambling scandal in baseball with umpires, I think it would ruin baseball. Everybody would lose any faith they had in the game.
Let me go back.
It would be a tragedy.
Yeah. Ed Rommel.
I didn't know Ed Rommel.
Oh, you didn't?
No, sir.
Okay. Al Bartlett.
Al Bartlett I knew, because he was in the National League, not in the American League.
Yeah, he was.
Al, of course, was a very peppery and well-liked umpire, a very talented umpire.
Uh-huh.
I like Al. I still like him.
I always heard he was kind of a no-nonsense umpire. He didn't take any lip from anybody.
Very much like Jack O'Connor.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They were kind of the same mold. I think Connor broke Bartlett in.
And they kind of...
He created the clone, I think.
Okay.
Good man, both of them.
And who'd you model yourself after when you came up to the majors? I'm sure there was somebody that you singled yourself, hey, I want to stick with this guy because I can learn from him.
Well, I think when I went into professional baseball, I could not have named one major league umpire. I don't think I could have named
really?
One. I never watched umpires. I watched the game and I watched the players. I could never have told you who the umpires were until I got into umpiring.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, I knew them because I wanted to get their job.
Yeah.
And I became familiar with their habits. But as far as copying, I probably stole 50 different ways of umpiring from them and combined them and used them the best way I could. I might take a strike from one. I may take a stance from another. I might take a position from another. How to handle a situation from another. I think we all steal from each other.
Yeah, we do.
And never stop learning.
That's right.
I still do it. I watch these kids work now. I still see things. I think I'll try that.
Hmm.
It's just keep trying.
Yeah, just.
I don't think I've ever called a strike the same way twice. I never say strike, so it's a peep or a boop or. It's just something different all the time.
I've heard on calling strikes that there's a black line. That's the term I have heard. Are you familiar with that term?
I think I know what you mean. I use tunnel vision. I set my eyes to a position I think is the zenith of the zone, the top of the zone. And I put my eyes there. That's where I set my head.
Right above the catcher's head.
And I get a tunnel vision. No, I'm usually beside him. Whichever.
Okay.
And I set a tunnel. And if the ball's outside that tunnel, I call the ball. And I don't have to move my head to find out if it's outside that tunnel. But if it's outside that tunnel, it's the ball. Now, that may be different for every umpire.
Well, that leads me then to the question that when I played ball, the kneecaps and the letters.
You'll never find two umpires with the same strike zone.
Well, I tell you, I'm finding down that it could dig up dirt and it's going to be a strike. The strike zone has really shrunk.
I teach umpiring here in the college level here. And I tried to tell them to widen the strike zone by going inside or outside to expedite the game somewhat.
Okay.
And never to make a fool of themselves by calling high strikes or low strikes. Everybody in the ballpark knows when you're calling a high pitch a strike.
Yeah.
They know it's not a strike. Uh-huh. So you've made a fool of yourself, basically. And that's what I tell them because I think I get to them a little better. And the same thing with a low pitch, something near the dirt. They know it's a ball, and you're calling it a strike. I just try to tell them to get a zone, but widen it. Nobody knows I'm with.
I know, but what I'm seeing in the American League, they have a lower strike zone. In the National League, I think...
It's the opposite of it.
Is the opposite. Now, you know, it's something characteristic...
Well, the bottom of the American League zone was higher than the National League zone.
Uh-huh.
And the top of the zone was higher,
yeah.
And the National League was lower.
Yeah.
So, I just can't buy that. I don't see
don't
that
buy
much
that
difference.
Kind of,
no, I don't see that much difference. I really don't.
Oh, okay.
I think the strike zone has gotten so small up there that it's gotten ridiculous. I mean, they don't call strikes here anymore. That's not a strike.
I know.
And that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
To me, the strike was here, but
perhaps
now they're
that's
not
part
even.
Part of the reason they have a 3-hour game all the time.
3 hours plus.
They don't have quick games anymore because they don't call strikes.
Yeah.
The idea, to me, I try to teach these umpires. In the first inning, I want the catchers, both catchers, one from each team,
mm-hmm.
to go back to the dugout saying, we better swing the bat. It's calling strikes. Now, if you can get those two catchers to go back to the dugout in the first inning and do that, you're going to have a fast game.
That's right. Don't set
their way. Everybody's going to be up to not looking for walks. They're going to be swinging.
Yeah, they're going to be swinging.
You set the tone for a game. Players don't do it. You set the pace, you set the tone. If you finish an inning and you just stand there and you loll around,
mm-hmm.
that's just what the players do. They'll walk out the positions. But if you walk down the line and hustle a team out of the bench, they're going to hustle for you because they want to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be part of it to solve it.
I heard that the best compliment you can give to an umpire is when the crowd doesn't know that he's around.
I think that was probably true 30 years ago, but I think right now the umpires, because the psyche of the umpires changed, they all want to be recognized and known, I think.
They kind of want to excel in the spotlight along with the
other
players.
I can relate it to just these kids. They all want to work at the University of Miami because that's where the 6,000 people are.
Yeah.
And that's where they announce the names before the game and all this kind of stuff, and it's in the paper. And to them, that's what they're all shooting for. Of course, the umpires and the minors are doing the same thing wanting to get in the big leagues. They all want to be known.
Yeah.
That factor of not being known just doesn't hold anymore.
It doesn't work.
No.
What did it take for you to throw out a player in the game?
Personal offense, I think. More than anything, personal offense. I don't want to put that on the
table.
Well,
I know some of the cuss words.
Well, just like, you know, if somebody walked up to you and said, well, I'll be a...
Yeah.
And they said, use the word. Now, if you like the guy, you just ignore it.
Yeah.
And if you didn't like him, you'd agree with him, and you'll probably have to get him.
Because
he's calling himself something, and you're agreeing. But as long as they didn't come up to me and said, you, and address it to me personally, I took a lot, I think.
Even if they put kick dirt on your shoes?
No, they're gone. There are some things that are automatic. Throwing of equipment, throwing of hats, throwing gloves, bats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kicking dirt on an umpire, even kicking dirt at an umpire, throwing equipment towards an umpire. All those things are automatic.
Yeah.
You're really not throwing anybody.
But Earl Weaver and Ralph Houck and Billy Martin got by with that quite a bit.
Well, no, they had a regular routine. Ralph Houck would always let you know when he wanted to leave a game. Never took his hat off till he wanted to leave. If you get back in the archives and you get hold of film, any time he was run, it was because he threw his hat. He never got run without throwing his hat. That was his key to the umpires. Okay, that's the end of the argument. Get me the hell out of here. And he'd throw his hat. And some umpires were kicking. But the next day, Ralph Houck came up to home plate, and that was a pretty good show. I mean, the guy was, he was a gentleman from the word go. Mm-hmm. But that was his routine. Billy Martin's routine was, okay, I'll kick dirt.
Uh-huh.
He was gone.
Uh-huh.
He knew that he was going to go. He was setting the tone himself. You didn't have to run them. They ran themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Weaver usually either touched you or bumped you or got too close to you,
yeah,
or turned his hat around,
yeah,
or flipped his,
yeah,
hat. They all give you a key. They all give you a clue when they want to go.
So you had re-scouting reports the way
when you talked to each other, everybody knew. Uh-huh. See what Billy did while he wanted to go. We knew that.
Uh-huh.
They all had keys. They all had keys.
Uh-huh. I heard a story, now this story, that long before the days that you went into Major League umpiring, about Connie Mack, who owned the Philadelphia Athletics, that he was the only manager, one, that has nothing to do with what I want to ask, that never wore a baseball uniform.
True.
And, of course, the way he was built, he might have looked kind of funny wearing a uniform. Looked like Ichabod Crane. But secondly, that he never would ever go out on the ball field during the game. If he wanted to talk with an umpire, he would get his brother, go around the backstop, and tell the ump, Connie Mack wants to see you, and the ump would call timeout and walk to the dugout and find out what Connie Mack wanted.
Well, that was part of the agreement with Connie Mack, that he could never leave the dugout in too many clothes. Otherwise, he would not have been allowed to sit there. Had he ever come out of the dugout in civilian clothes, he would never again be allowed to sit in there.
Oh, really?
That's why he never came out of the dugout.
Darn. I wasn't aware of
sure.
That was the agreement.
If he had come out, he would have been gone and he'd never have been allowed to sit there again without a uniform. That's the baseball rules say nobody's in there except uniformed
players,
coaches, managers, and the doctors, trainers.
I thought it might have had something to do with his influence in the American League.
I think his influence got them to allow him to do it. But it was countered by he could not come out.
He'd have to...
That's right. But, you know, I talked to old-timers who worked during his time, and he used to chirp from the dugout, but he'd never come out of the field.
Hmm.
He knew he couldn't come out.
Okay.
He rode a good boat. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he knew.
He did.
Ed Hurley, going back to some names of umpires.
I never worked with Ed. Ed, and it was a tragic when he died so early in life, but Ed was a good umpire. That's all I can say about him. I've seen him work, but I never worked with him.
Of all the calls in the outfield, now you talked about Fenway Park and the signs up there, home run, in play, what have you. Was a trap ball the most in the outfield the most difficult play to, other than some of the ground rules?
But trap plays are always tough. Always tough if you don't get a right angle. There's no way you can tell.
Well, it could be harder on the infield because you might be behind the infielders and not see it.
I can only tell you one incident where I was involved very greatly with one like that in Boston, in your favorite park, Fenway Park, where someone hit a ball to the outfield. It was Minnesota was involved, and Boston was at bat, and it was bases loaded with 2 men on anyway. A couple of runs scored. The ball was hit to the outfield. Man dove for it. And all I could see was white on the ground.
Uh-huh.
You know, probably 200 feet away from it, 150 feet. And I ruled no catch. Runners were scoring. Of course, he came up with the ball in his hand, but I ruled I could see the white on the ground. And I ended up running Gene Mark and I think four or five others. And the bad part was I had a ride with them on a plane back to Minnesota after this game, but that's not part of the story. The television crew came to me after the game in the dressing room and said that they had run it from 11 different angles, and they all showed a ball on the ground until they got to one camera that showed it was the man's sweatband. He wore a white sweatband, and that's what was on the ground. In other words, his hand was like that.
Okay.
You could see the white. And they kept saying, I don't know what in their own vernacular, they were saying they couldn't understand why the team was arguing with me on the play. Uh-huh. It was obvious the ball was on the ground. Uh-huh. But it wasn't the ball. It was that.
And they issued
a thing about 2 weeks later saying no more white sweatbands in the outfield. Yeah. That was a bugger.
I hope it was a pleasant trip on the way back.
It was. Basically, those things.
Leave it behind. Yeah. Is a ball hard to call?
Is a ball hard to call?
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably the worst ball man in baseball.
I always had
to drop it and have it bounce or something before.
Called it more than anybody?
No, I didn't call him.
You didn't call him?
No, I didn't like the call anyway. But balks, for some reason, I just didn't call them. Not that I didn't see them, but I didn't react to them. Probably because I didn't like it.
Well, it's up to the plate umpire to call
it. No, anybody can call a ball. Anybody. I've called balks, don't misunderstand me. I've called a lot of balks. But I probably have missed twice as many as I've called.
Now,
it is a tough call. It's not really tough because it's basic.
Yes. But if you have, you say, the tunnel vision, you're waiting for that to come in.
So you got to be concentrated on that. When you miss balks, it's lack of concentration. It's lack of concentration. And I didn't concentrate.
Well, did some of the pitchers try to get the by with you on that?
Yeah.
And you get your reputation, hey, he's a...
Palmer got me one time in Baltimore. And Weaver knew I didn't like to call balks.
Uh-huh.
And Palmer, instead of stepping towards first, would step towards home and come over to first. And there was one instance where he did it 5 times. Each step progressively worse, closer towards home plate.
Uh-huh.
And I think the 5th time I finally balked him.
Uh-huh.
Of course, Weaver came charging on. He said, you don't call balks. What are you doing? And Palmer was standing around laughing like a banshee. And he told me after the game, he said, Weaver said, just see how far you can go.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I hated balks.
Uh-huh.
But you had to call him.
Yeah. Would you be in favor of the replay that they're doing in professional football and baseball?
Well, I just don't want to see them take the human element out of the game. Umpires are going to make mistakes. Football officials are going to make mistakes. And I think, number one, it prolongs the game. I would never want them to see a reverse in umpire's decision in baseball because there are almost 400 decisions in a game. Ball, strike, safe, sounds.
About the average number of calls?
Well, there are
total?
About 300 pitches, basically. At least 300 pitches.
Yeah, you figured that.
And there's got to be another 54. We know safe, sit outs.
Well, 27, yeah.
It's got to be 400
calls.
Yeah,
you got over 400 calls.
Almost 400 calls in a ballgame.
Yeah.
Probably closer to 500. And if they start running replays and calling games up to look at replays, the game's going to take 6 hours. They're taking over 3 now.
Yeah. And a lot of people complain it's taking too long now.
Sure. Look at football. They hold them up for 5 minutes sometimes.
Yeah.
I know the rule says they have to do it in 30 seconds or 50 seconds or whatever it is now, but it's not done that way. And they do it 10 or 15 times a game. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Leave the human element in it.
Yeah. Keep
don't,
it in there.
Don't take it out. That's part of the game.
Well, do that then. With the TV screens up there in the ballparks, don't show any replays then.
Well,
shouldn't that be part of the rule?
Yeah,
then?
We had some incidents about it. As a matter of fact, Houston. I can't think who the general manager was at the time. One of the Bavazes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of the sons was the GM of Houston, I think. And he ran a controversial play back on the screen. It was obviously against the umpire.
Yeah.
And it created a riot. So the National League, I know, that year put it up, they could not show replays of any controversial play.
Now, that's still the rule in Major League now?
I don't know. It was when I left in 83 or 84.
The evolution of umpiring equipment, I first asked you about the balloon versus the inside. Has there been any other change in umpiring equipment? I imagine the steel tip shoes remain the same, but is there any other change in equipment?
Everything's a little more sophisticated, I think. The masks are lighter. They've added that flap down there for your larynx, which I can't wear, but I don't like it, but it's there. It's a safety measure. The shoes are much better if you can get them. There are very few people that make them. Chest protectors are smaller, much more sturdier.
Mm-hmm.
They're using some sort of material that the astronauts use. I don't know what it
mm-hmm.
is. It really absorbs shock. So it has evolved quite a bit. It's much better equipment.
Yeah. Learn to keep your hands behind your back when calling.
I have every finger broken.
You have every. Let me take a look at your finger.
They've all been broken.
But you didn't keep your fingers behind your back.
No. I just stayed out there.
You know, when I learned to catch,
one hand behind.
They said put that hand behind.
I always had this hand behind the catcher. I put this on his back usually. Sometimes, whichever side I was on, I'd put one hand on his back. The other one was just there.
He got hit.
It didn't hurt that much.
Well, I see him doing some tiptoeing and...
breaks fingers. But, you know, I can remember, and I don't mean to be derogatory anyway, but I'm personally, I'm considered a great group. But I can remember being hit in a game in Tulsa, Oklahoma once. I had four toes broken at one time in the fourth inning of a game, and I finished the game.
Four toes broken
in one shot. And now, I see umpires get hit in the mask, and they reel backwards, and they fall down, and they get hit in the leg where the shin guard is, and they hop around, and they get it frozen. I'm not saying we were tougher then, but I think we were schooled then not to show you a hurt ever.
Yeah.
You know, I got hit in the heart once. So, I mean, a throw from the pitcher to the first baseman. Chambliss was the first baseman. And he just didn't catch the ball. It went right by his glove and hit me right in the heart.
Mm.
And I just stood there. I couldn't breathe, but I didn't move. Mm-hmm. The trainer came running out. The Yankee doctor came running out. I said, Yankee Stadium. And Martin came running out. And he said, Jesus, lay down. And I said, I can't say what I said to him. They left.
Uh-huh.
But it hurt. And that was the schooling that I had.
That's what you brought up as a kid.
Yeah, and not only as a kid, but even in baseball.
Yeah.
The old expression, rubbing the dirt.
Yeah.
Doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah. Don't show your hurt.
Now everybody shows hurt.
Yeah.
I don't care if they just get nicked. Oh, it's a big show.
Yeah.
And that's their thing, I guess. We're all different.
You do a lot of evaluating of umpires today.
I do on a college level, yes.
Okay. What do you look for to find out those umpires that are on their way up? What do you see in them that says, hey, they got the goods, they know the basics, that they're going to go up, you know, higher up the minor leagues, on up to the majors. How do you spot that kind of umpire?
I look for three ingredients in a man when he comes to me or he starts in our association. As a matter of fact, you have a boy working this Nova game here today that I think may make a big league.
Mm-hmm.
Out of school now, and he's going into the minor leagues this year.
Yeah.
He's a Cuban black boy.
Mm-hmm. I saw him come over there on the
Diaz is his name. Remember it, because I think you may be interviewing him
someday.
I look for three things, basically. I look for character, which is not always easy to find, but I look for character in a man. I look for instincts, baseball instincts. Not having to be taught to go somewhere, or not having to be taught to watch the ball.
You mean anticipate?
Yeah. I hate that word, anticipate.
Why?
But instinctive, because you can't anticipate something happening, because it won't. It'll go the other way.
Okay.
You anticipate the ball being thrown to first.
Uh-huh.
It'll go to second.
Okay.
But I want them to instinctively know where the ball's going to go. And it's not easy to spot, but you can't spot it. Believe me, you can.
Well, give me an example.
And I look for their ability to control situations.
Control. Okay.
I will create them sometimes. I will go to a manager and say, I want you to really get on this.
Just see.
I had a kid 2 years ago that had all the talents in the world to umpire. And I told him, Miami-Dade North, Ranieri, what's his name? I forget his name. I asked him to go up and just really ride this umpire. Mm-hmm. Get on, curse him, call him any name he could. And he did. And the only umpire I said to him was, thanks a lot, coach, I needed that. Never ran him, never berated him in any way, never told him to get away from him. Just said, so I dropped him.
Yeah.
There's no way this man's ever going to control the game.
No.
So I dropped him. But he had all the character in the world, everything.
Except that.
Fear. So I have to figure this out.
Yeah.
How do you spot it? I don't know how you spot somebody with instincts. I took a kid off the street about 5 years ago. He was living in a car. He was eating bacon sandwiches and ham sandwiches in the back of a car. And I took him to an umpire's meeting. Sounds like Alcoholics Anonymous or something.
Yeah.
I took him to an umpire's meeting. I said, you sit down and take this test. And I sat next to him, and I gave him about 90% of the answers. And I wanted him off the street. And we've taught him how to umpire. He's a kid that's got a record. He's a narcotic addict at one time. He's straight now. He has been for 10 years or more. Matter of fact, he did undercover work at one time. But he's a straight kid. And if you saw him now umpiring, you'd be amazed. In 5 years, he knew nothing. He had never umpired a game in his life. He'd never done baseball. Now he manages a town team in Minnesota, and he umpires Big Ten baseball and comes down here 4 months a year and works with us.
Streetwise, though.
Oh. Crude. I mean, it's crude a manager you don't want to meet.
Yeah.
But not anymore. But you could see instincts in him. I saw him watching a game that's when I met him. Mm-hmm. He was watching a game, and I was sitting near him. And I could hear his conversation. I said, oh, geez, why did you do that? Gee, it's going over there. Doesn't he know that's worth going? And he had instinct. So I grabbed him, and I said, what do you do for a living? What do you do? And he said, well, I was living in my car. And he's having a part of that. He's going to regionals this year. So instincts. Sometimes you miss. You do miss.
Yeah.
I'm sure you do the same thing with your students.
I have some faculty that I've selected and I bombed.
Sure. You look for things in a person and you think you find it, sometimes you miss.
Yeah. I'm going to turn this tape over because we'll just finish right after that.
Okay, while you're doing that, I'm going to go to the bedroom.
Oh, okay, yep. This is side two of a conversation with George Maloney, former American League umpire. Forgot where we left off, George, on the other part, but...
We were looking for what I was looking for.
Okay, those three things.
I recruited umpires.
You saw some fantastic ball players in your days in the American League. And many of them were later members of the Hall of Fame. You mentioned one, Jim Palmer. What do you remember about Roger Maris? You know, he passed away recently. He never made it to the Hall of Fame yet anyway. But I heard he was one of the greatest team players that the Yankees had, but got so much pressure on him from the press about breaking Babe Ruth's record. What do you remember about Roger Maris?
I think Roger Maris was an angry man. He resented the fact that his... when he hit the 61 home runs, that it was over a longer season. And, he was downgraded, and he was not in the class.
Yeah.
And I think he was a very angry man. He was certainly a great hitter.
Yeah.
Angry. That's the only way I could describe
him. Even before before that season?
Yeah, I think so. He was an angry man.
I mean, you wouldn't get it. You could get angry in 1 year, but there had to be seeds of it long before then.
I don't think he was ever treated quite fairly.
Yeah.
By the press especially.
Yeah. I heard stories where he'd have a bad day and they'd still come up to interview him when there were some other guys that played that won the game for the Yankees, but they all wanted to interview him even though he might have gone 0-for-4.
He never had a minute to himself.
No, had no...
just no privacy.
Ralph Houk told me that toward the end of the season his hair turned white.
He was going great. I always told Ralph Houk that it was his fault. His antics for the both. We were just kidding.
Yeah. A favorite player of mine that really always hustled a lot, still playing, Rick Dempsey. Did you? Who came up with the Yankees and then went with Baltimore and then now with the Dodgers. I don't know where he is now.
Well, I think he's been offered a a contract. Well, he's been told to come to spring training. I don't think it's with the...
I think it was Oakland, if I remember.
It's with somebody else. I don't know who it is.
I mean, he's been around for a good 20 or more years.
He's been around.
But...
never the umpire's favorite.
Really? What, did he squawk at everything?
Yeah, he was a squawker. He would get Weaver on you more often than
really?
Anybody else. But Rick was a good catcher. I don't carry personal stuff. I do know one incident where he wrote to the commissioner of baseball or the league president, I forget what he's saying, that the umpires were picking on him. Because the bad part is we probably were. You hate to see an honest letter like that.
Yeah, that's right. at least you can reject a dishonest letter of stuff and say, yeah, that's
true.
That's pretty tough, man. But another catcher that come to mind, and I've had a lot of respect for it because I've only seen them on the field, is Carlton Fisk. And, you know, there was an incident last season when that Deion Sanders playing with the Yankees, you know, where they sold him away or did something with him, that there was a pop-up foul along first baseline. Sander just kind of, oh, well, foul ball. I'm going to walk back in the dugout. I'm not going to run it out. And Fisk chased his ass and got sore as hell at him. So no, that's not the way to play the game of baseball.
Fisk is probably the most intense player I think I've ever run into. A catcher, certainly. Took the game very seriously.
I think he does.
Keeps himself in tremendous condition. I don't know how he does it. But on the other side of Fisk was, you could never have a game under 3 hours with Fisk catching because he makes it minimum of 30 trips to the mound a game. We used to actually corral him sometimes, grab him by the seat of his pants and say, where are you going, Carl? Stay here. No, I got to talk to Fisk. He makes it, you count him sometimes. You ever go to a White Sox game?
Well, I watch him when he comes up to bat and he has to go through these gymnastics and takes him forever and a day.
He's just incredible. But you have to give it to him. The man's intense, and he's got talent. God, he's got talent.
Yeah. Well, what is it, 22 years now?
At least, I'm sure it is.
And after every game, does his calisthenics, does his weightlifting?
Physical conditioning and concentration. Mm-hmm. And just the game's never out of his mind once it starts.
There were some players that, if they had really done that kind of physical conditioning, even with, could have stayed in the game longer. One comes to my mind is Mickey Mantle. Even though he had those leg injuries.
Mickey didn't have a choice, really. His legs were just too bad. Even now, you see him, it's a shame. I go up and work the fantasy camp with him. For him to walk is a pain. He just can't move. And his legs, he got tape every game.
I heard stories about taping it up, looked like an Egyptian mummy.
I think he did everything he could do.
He did everything he could.
I believe that. He and George Brett, I think, the best natural heroes ever.
Mm-hmm. They just they had that eye, and they knew how to control the bat. And
their time and their wrist. Great hitters.
We've talked about an hour, George. I know that.
I usually talk about that.
Because the first time we met, I know you... From what your wife has said, what Sonny has said, that you've got a wealth of stories. I hope that maybe the three of us could get together and share some of those stories. At least those could be put on tape. But you retired in the mid '60s.
No, I retired in '84.
'84?
Yeah. I came up in the end of '60.
Okay,
69.
I'm sorry. In '69, you came up. In '84, okay. What have you seen changed in terms of the strategy of playing ball? And I'll give you an idea of what I meant. I heard a story one time that Red Shandies when he played shortstop, I think, for the St. Louis Cardinals with Stan Musial. And he would bat right ahead of Musial. And Shandies said that a lot of times he would stop at first, even though he possibly could have gone to second, stretched into a double, but he didn't because Musial was coming up.
Had to pitch him.
And if they had first base wide open, they would have walked him, so they had to pitch to him. I don't see that happening so much today. All I hear about is that this guy hits 40 home runs and steals 40 bases, whether or not the 40 bases make a difference in the outcome of the game. Do you see, is that a, something that you've seen?
That's a big change in stealing bases because there are so many players now that have a green light regardless of the situation to steal.
Whether it has any bearing on the game
they're
or that
given a green light. I don't know if Ricky Henderson still has it enough, and he was one that had a green light to go any time he wanted to. Certainly Brock had a green light.
Yeah.
A lot of players. But then you're bringing up two names that are sort of legends in this game, Shane Deans and Musial. I doubt if you could name another combination with that kind of talent where people could hit doubles and stuff with singles and get on base with it as often as Shane Deans would do with a man like Musial following. It's just not done.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't. I guess that's a unique combination when
Put two talented men like that together.
Right.
You can do anything you want on both.
Yeah, that's right.
I doubt if you could name a pair that could do it.
No, I can't.
I don't think so. The closest thing might be a Ricky Henderson and this kid from Miami.
Mm-hmm. If he can...
Canseco. Raw talent. They have raw talent.
Yeah, they do. Well, I'm going to first thank you very much for being part of this project with the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I can make whatever number of copies you would like for your own personal record, for yourself, for your family. And then I'll mail them to you. I'll mail the master copy to Bill Guilfoyle up at the Hall of Fame.
I would just appreciate one copy.
Okay, one copy of it. Okay, well, I'll make a copy for you and send it to your... But I need your address. This is the end of the conversation with George Maloney, former American League umpire.